Friends of Jesus Christ, in the movie, The Tree of Life, there's the narrator, the voice, that says at the very beginning that there are two ways to live life. There is the way of grace, and there is the way of nature. The way of grace is to receive life as a gift, a magnificent gift from God. It is a thing of splendor to be delighted in and to share. On the way of grace, those who serve are the greatest. The way of nature receives or sees life as a fight. It calls for one to assert oneself, to grasp power, to wield it however carefully in order to yield, to make people yield to your desires and wants. The way of nature is a Darwinian world, red in tooth and claw. Here the strongest survive and the wisest live on the street luxurious. There's the way of grace and the way of nature. And in some ways, those two ways run through every heart here. And it's also true that as Christians, we want very much to have the way of grace dominate. For the way of grace is the Jesus way. And as pilgrims, we are called to walk the way of grace. And that's why it seems to me so fitting that the Basic English Service always concludes their service with the song, "To Grow in Grace." To grow in grasping the magnificence of God's goodness to us and to live life gratefully, to grow in grace. Now Psalm 123 tells us that pilgrims who are on the journey on the way of grace, when they are in trouble, they lift their eyes to the Lord. "To you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. As the eyes of the servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God until he has mercy upon us." This lifting of the eyes is, of course, a gesture of appeal. And it comes not out of fearfulness, but out of confidence that our help lies in this one. And when the psalmist defines or describes the one to whom we lift our eyes, it doesn't say what we heard in Psalm 121, where the psalmist says, "I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where comes my help? My help comes from the one who made the heavens and the earth." Here, we lift our eyes to the one who sits enthroned in the heavens. Now, when he refers to heavens, don't think remote or distant, but think other. Eugene Peterson, he says we mustn't understand the psalmist to be either a geographer or an astronomer. He's a theologian, and he is making clear a profound truth, namely that at the very center of our existence is not a black hole, is not magic, but a throne, and that the one who sits on the throne is the one to whom we look. It speaks of God as sovereign. He has the power. He has the power. And so we look to him. We look to him, says the psalmist, as servants look to the hand of their master, and as a maid looks to the hand of her mistress. Now this comparison is actually very telling about our relationship to God. And it says, I think, at least two things. It does not say that we, before God, have a kind of slave mentality. Passive. Fearful. Rather, it speaks, first of all, to a sane and sober understanding of reality. That God is like a master, and we are like servants. You could change or add other comparisons. That as a child looks to her parents, as a student looks to his teacher, as a patient looks to their physicians, there is this assumption that there is power, there is capacity that we don't have, but that God has. So it speaks to the reality that we are creatures and that God is our creator, that he is sovereign. And that what it calls for on our part is a stance of humility. And by humility, I mean the simple acknowledgement that we are creatures. It is to declare that we are dependent. There is no room for arrogance or pretentiousness or boasting or fanaticism. We are creatures. We are very much creatures. It's humility, in a sense, that creates the soil in which all the theological virtues of hope, faith, and love can grow. Without humility, the virtues cannot flourish. As a servant to the master, as a maid to the mistress, so we as creatures to the creator. And it struck me as I was thinking about this humility, this smallness on our part, this in some sense powerlessness, is so very much underscored by science. I mean, science has told us, for instance, that the universe is a vast ocean, that the nearest star after the sun is, 270,000 light years from Earth? And that we are in a universe that they say began some 14 billion years ago? That your existence and my existence is like the flick of a firebug and no more. We are so profoundly insignificant. To have the conceit that somehow we are in control, we have life in our grasp, is just so utterly nonsense. And if it were not for the fact that we as God's creatures are crowned with his love, we might well despair of our smallness, of our helplessness. But as pilgrims on the way of grace, we acknowledge that we are not creators, that we do not have life in our grasp, that the very fact of our life is a sign of a gift from the Creator. And so we look to him. We look to him as a maid to a mistress, as a student to a teacher, as a physician, as a patient to a physician. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the fact that our relationship to God is like the servant master made mistress speaks to a kind of covenant. You know what I mean? I mean, the master, being the master, a good master, has obligations to look after, to pay at the very least, his servants. There is a kind of understanding that the servant serves and that the master provides. As a parent, for instance, you may have the power, but the power for your children must be used to serve them. It speaks so remarkably, it seems to me, that the God of the universe, for whom all things might be no bigger than a nut in his hand, that God would commit himself to us. I mean, you know, we're mostly we're educated, intellectual, living and going in schools. And we don't have, I'm told, very many business people. Now, that may not be true. But I should tell you, I know a few business people, and those business people feel a real responsibility for their employees. They will stay up at night wondering where to find the market to sell the goods to keep their workers working. They have this sense of obligation. And so likewise, God, we say, we have a claim on his attention. We're in a covenant relationship, and we will wait, and we will wait till he responds to us. Now, what is it for which we wait? We wait for his mercy. As the eyes of the servant, as the eye of the maid, so our eyes look to the Lord our God until he has mercy upon us. Have mercy upon us, O Lord. Have mercy upon us, for we have had more than enough of contempt. Two things. First, the mercy. The mercy, it's pity. It's grace, really. It's oftentimes associated with forgiving sins. Most often, though, it comes by showing compassion for her. I mean, this mercy becomes embodied in Jesus Christ. As Jesus heals the sick, welcomes children, makes the stranger a son or daughter of Abraham, in all of those ways, when he takes our burdens to the cross, in all of those ways, he shows mercy. Mercy is a kindness, a favor. And now we're asking God to be merciful to us. Why? Because we've had it up to here with contempt. Now that's a very interesting thing. For we have had more than enough. There are twice it talks about being filled. We're up to here with contempt. Contempt is this being treated or feeling like you're more or less worthless. You really don't matter much. It's being ridiculed. One translator says it's this feeling of being shamed, having no glory, no weight. Now, in the scriptures, there are a number of places where you see that kind of contempt shown God's people. I'll give you a couple of instances. In 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19, the Assyrians have gathered, or the army has gathered around Jerusalem, and they're telling the people to surrender. And a leader from the Assyrian army is making a speech, and the Israelites say, oh, don't speak in the language they will understand. You'll just so discourage them. And then the leader said, look, they should know that if they don't behave, they're going to be eating their own dung and drinking their own urine. And I want to tell them that if they follow us, and here he acts just like the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, if you follow us, I will take you to a land, he promises the people sitting there on the walls, that will be overflowing with milk and honey, and every man will sit under his own vine. And don't for a minute believe in the king's promise, Hezekiah, that your God will be able to deliver you from the hand of the Assyrians. Hey, listen. Every other nation thought their gods could deliver them, and they are now dust. This sneering. Hezekiah takes these words into the temple and lays them down on the altar and says, okay, God, have mercy on us. Right? The Psalms sometimes ring of this. In Psalm 42, for instance, when the psalmist says, I long for God as a deer longs for water, there's the voice that says, and where is your God now? Where is he now? You trusted him? Shh! Give me a break. Your child is sick. The child dies. There's another place in Nehemiah, when Nehemiah and the people, as they return from exile, they want to rebuild the wall. And there are people who don't want that wall rebuilt, and they scoff and they ridicule and they say, you could not possibly make a wall strong enough to keep us out. Why, your walls are so weak, if a fox walks on it, it will begin to crumble. Scoffing. Jesus, of course, is the prime example of being scoffed and scorned. Think of that instance where they blindfold Jesus and then start punching him, and they say, okay, now guess who hit you? You idiot. You pathetic fool. This scorn. Now, I don't know whether you've ever felt contempt or scorn. I mean, I find that every once in a while when I read, you know, I mean, we experience it in different ways. But Dawkins, may God be merciful to him. But he has nothing but scorn and contempt for the believer. He's written a book for children. It just came out. And the reviewer says, here's Dawkins. He's like an uncle who comes to your Thanksgiving dinner, family Thanksgiving dinner, and while the grandpa talks about the goodness of the Creator, he winks at the teenagers as if to say, that's all bullcrap. There is no God. Get over it. Grow up. Contempt. So sometimes this contempt comes from our own misdoings. We feel so shamed by what we do or how we responded to a certain situation. Or people within in our own family can sometimes so seem to diss us, to set us aside like we don't matter and count. This contempt, feeling like you've had it up to here. I mean, as recent immigrants, it's very possible to find yourselves thinking, you know, they don't, just because I don't speak their language as well as they speak it, but then they wouldn't be able to speak my Nepalese either, but never mind, they feel as though I was unimportant. It's this feeling of contempt. And however it comes home to you, I gotta say one other little thing. It comes from those who are at ease, the contempt of the proud. The proud here is, of course, a subjective feeling. I feel proud. But as a matter of fact, it doesn't necessarily have to be a subjective thing. They might not think themselves proud at all. The word can also be an objective, meaning they feel majestic. They're on the faculty of an Ivy League school. Their bodies are sleek. They relieve themselves whenever they want of hunger, whether for food or sex or whatever. They are powerful people. And the psalmist says, have mercy on us. Now, you know, what the psalmist doesn't do in this very, very brief psalm is to say what form that mercy should show itself. Right? My own thought is, well, Psalm 124 will start elaborating a bit, but Psalm 73 is a classic case where the psalmist says, I looked at the godless and I saw how they prospered and how well things went for them, and I thought, I am crazy for being faithful. And then he says, he goes into the temple, and he sees the face of God, and he realizes what their end will be. And I don't mean necessarily hell, but their end is that they will be strangers to God. Their souls will shrivel. Their souls will shrivel. And so one of the ways, and I'll, you know, if I were a betting man, I'd bet that I'm not alone when I say that so often God's grace that becomes so enormously strengthening is when in worship or just walking down the street or driving the car, I experience that face of God, the goodness of God. And I am strengthened. It need not be just that. It can be, since God is sovereign, that things will change in my circumstances. But what strengthens is when God's face smiles on us, when God's face is turned towards us and he gives us peace. Pope Benedict, who just returned from a trip to Germany, where you know, people were very critical of him, but he says, you know, being humiliated, being disregarded, may in fact be a way in which we are reminded again of what is truly our hope, what is truly our significance. And then he says, wherever there is God, there is a future. And wherever the love of God is welcomed, there's something of heaven is experienced. And the ordinary things become important. And the great problems become manageable. As pilgrims who travel the way of grace in times of trouble, we look to you, O Lord, enthroned in the heavens. And we wait till you show us your face, till you show us your presence, till you show us your hand. We wait till you show us your mercy. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.